Hello. And if that sounds a rather inadequate greeting the way I do it, just think what our great British comedians have been able to get out of the same two syllables.
Hello, everybody. Hello.
Oh, hello, hello, hello.
Hello, Playmate.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, Nigeria.
Hello.
And hello to them. Some of the voices, all of them beloved in their time, who have invited British audiences to share their company over the years in that strange experience, radio comedy. I mean, if you'd told a citizen of medieval England that one day it was going to be possible for someone many hundreds of miles away to make him laugh, possible, in fact, for someone no longer even alive to give him the giggles, well, he'd no doubt have thought the gates of Bedlam had fallen off again. But a few years later, shortly after the First World War, this idea became a real possibility with the formation of the British Broadcasting Company, a commercial venture, under the leadership of Mr. J.C.W. Reith. Mr. Reith was 6 feet 6 inches tall and felt he was born to be a leader of men. But at the time of his application to run the BBC, he didn't actually know what broadcasting was. Nor was Lord Reith of Stonehaven, as he later became, your ideal man to keep the public entertained. Informed, perhaps. Educated, certainly. Instructed would perhaps be the best word. But for the world of entertainment, life had not prepared him, as John Freeman found out in a famous TV interview.
Most people, at any rate in the south of England, would suppose that life in a manse in Glasgow was austere, not very exciting. On the whole, did your father bring you up to enjoy life or not?
No. There was great love from both my father and mother, but there was an austerity in my father's surroundings, and I never learnt that life was for living. Do I make myself clear?
You do, yes.
Yes, indeed he does. To be blunt about this, Lord Reith,
would you say you've got a sense of humour?
Yes, I have a sense of humour, but not as much as I wish I had.
A wish shared by Reith's colleagues at various times in the BBC's history. But fortunately, it wasn't only up to Reith to put things on the air, as the new poetic phrase had it. On his staff were people with an obvious flair for comedy, even if they indulged it in places you wouldn't expect. Take Captain Eckersley, for example. Peter Eckersley was an engineering maestro, genius, some said, and one of his tasks in 1922 was to test the primitive transmission and reception systems. The way Eckersley did it constituted certainly the most outrageous comedy performance heard on experimental radio up to that time.
Hello, DQ. Hello, DQ. This is 2M Atok. Ritual testing. This is 2M Atok. Ritual testing. All right now. Sorry, DQ. We had a slight technical hitch. DQ, tonight we have a most marvelous thing that's going to happen. We are going to receive Rome. That famous Italian tenor, what's his name? Grigliko is going to sing Non tutto furore fantissimo, which being translated means, it's very difficult. CQ, the concert ended. Farewell for Heterodyne. You must soon switch off your bells. I must soon switch off mine. Now we're going to receive it. There may be some atmospheric. There may be some jamming. There may be some oscillation. Woo! But hang on, CQ. We're just going to receive it now.
So saying, he tapped off to a distant piano, a sort of goon show effect 30 years ahead of its time, and started howling his impromptu opera. He was Magnifico Eckersley, 1922 style. Back in those early 20s, when listeners in, as they were called, had to do a lot of twiddling of knobs and cat's whiskers to stay tuned, it was safest in official broadcasts to put rather slow and static performers in front of the microphone. So it was that one of the very first comedians to make his name in the broadcasting studio was John Henry.
Hello, everybody. I'm just going to give you a short lecture on wireless. Of course, I like talking about wireless because wireless is a very wonderful thing. Anything that will make a woman listen must be wonderful, mustn't it? Now, wireless was invented by a man called Marconi. Of course, when I say he invented it, I mean he thought of it first, but I'm the man who perfected it and made it what it is. I got a fine wireless set that I made myself. I wouldn't mind betting that Martha in his wildest dreams never thought of anything like my set. Oh, it's a masterpiece. Of course, when I showed it to my friend Captain Eckersley of the BBC, he didn't call it that, although he admitted that he'd never seen anything like it, so you can tell what his private opinion is, can't you?
John Henry, talking about wireless and giving Captain Eckersley a mention on a gramophone record. These early broadcasting stars were usually given opportunities to make records, fortunately for us. John Henry's monologues turned into dialogues when he was interrupted by his wife, stage-named Blossom.
My set is what is called a married man's set. That is to say, there's no loudspeaker with it, because, of course, no married man wants two loudspeakers in the house, does he?
Oh, well, here are you, John Henry.
Yes, Blossom.
What are you doing?
Oh, I'm giving a wireless lecture.
A wireless lecture? What part of the subject are you talking about?
Well, it's a very funny thing, but I was just talking about the loudspeaker when you walked in.
As on the music halls, mothers-in-law and wives came in for traditional abuse. There was nothing newfangled about the humour. Many years later, Blossom came back to the microphone with memories of her partner, who may have been the first radio comic to benefit from that little mechanism of habit that can turn any repeated phrase into a catchphrase, however simple it is.
Ah, oh, well, used to say that quite a lot, ah, oh, well. Well, hello, everybody, of course. That became very well known. As soon as you said that, if he did, when he worked on the halls, he used to do Sunday leaves quite a lot. And before I went on, he used to appear first and tell stories, as nobody else in, from my point of view, could tell them. He just wore a dinner jacket, no help, no red nose, no baggy trousers, which, of course, I know are not allowed on Sunday. But even in the ordinary way, never had any makeup on at all, always a dinner jacket. And he just said, hello, everybody. And as soon as he said that, you know, there'd be a round of applause. He just, sheer personality. He's a most wonderful, very ugly man, but sheer personality.
Blossom, more than 30 years later. Her remark about what wasn't allowable on stage on a Sunday naturally applied in triplicate to Reek's broadcasting service. Nothing resembling light entertainment was heard on the day of rest. So comedy confined itself to weekdays and to studio space that was anything but inspiring.
There were sort of great curtains, very heavy, a sort of dead sound in the studio, and that frightful meat-safe which expected flies to fly, you know, round it all the time, that sort of blue gauze, and that sort of dead feeling all the time, muscles, but nothing exciting about it at all.
The old meat-safe microphone didn't allow for much hopping about in the studio, so the most standard form of radio entertainment in the early days was the talk, the simple scripted lecture, preferably by somebody with a mellifluous delivery, like the musician Sir Walter Davis, who for a time was probably the favourite in this line.
And the next thing is for us to remember that we left off, to me rather provokingly, in the very middle of the third part of our talks. The first part, of course, was about the remark in music, which Beethoven made such a feature of, and which since seems to have died. This kind of thing.
Sir Walter Davis with the serious talk. But because it was already becoming a rule in radio that everything serious soon acquired its comedy counterpart, there was also room for orotund comedians who did funny material in an equally plummy style.
Good evening, England. This is Gilly Potter speaking to you in English.
Gilly Potter, the sage of Hogs Norton, had such a strong style, overlapping a bit with Beachcomber, the newspaper humorist, that he was still announcing himself with that introduction in the Second World War. If the BBC had to have comedians, and it was clear now from public reaction that they were indispensable, then Potter was the sort of chap Reek was looking for.
Well, I think it was, because, as I used to say in my performance, there was nothing in it that would offend a child or a bookmaker. And they soon realized that, yes, you see, though Reek knew more children than bookmakers. And Sir John Reek, quite rightly, did not wish to hear the English language polluted, and of course he would not countenance anything that was not fit to come into a nice home.
It was middle-class people then, as now, who had nice homes. They certainly had most of the wireless sets at the time. So it tended to be the less well-off, with their funny voices, then as sometimes now, who provided something to laugh along with, or even perhaps to laugh at. Nowhere was this more obvious than in the string of character comedians who sprang up in the 20s, each with a slightly different slant on the gossipy, hard-done-by, sometimes malicious or lugubrious, and always frumpy old working woman. Bertha Wilmot, Mabel Constant-Dureff, Helena Millais, they all had big reputations playing characters who were household names. Helena Millais, for example, played Our Lizzie, and some typical monologues of Our Lizzie were put on record.
Hello, everybody. A comedy fragment from life, a Cockney sketch, entitled Our Lizzie Goes Shopping. Allow me, Dutch. Here I am again with my old string bag. Anything string bags, I say. I lost 2 pounds of beans last week. Didn't drop through the holes. Talk about the long, long trail. Here I kid the limit. When we were having tea the other day, there was Albert drinking his tea out of a saucer. But I says I'm ashamed of you, drinking your tea out of a saucer. Well, Ma, he says, if I drink it out of a cup, the drinking spoon goes up me nose. Hello, Mrs. Green, how are you? I ain't seen you since last time, have I? How's your old man? Go on. Well, I never. What's that? Oh, my old man's all right. Gone back to his old job. Looking for work.
Whenever I broadcast, I always did an Our Lizzie sketch. And she was really the first character to become famous over the air. She was the first character ever to become known as a character. I had to think of some way of getting her into a studio. I thought of making her the laundry woman of the BBC, so she had some excuse of coming to Savoy Hill and bringing the laundry for the various announcers and whoever was important and well-known in the BBC in those days. She used to supposed to do Mr. Reef's laundry and used to bring his shirts all tied up with blue ribbon, presumably, because he was so important.
Helena Millais in 1959. Back in her broadcasting heyday, there was a natural tendency for comedy on BBC Radio to be in some way about the BBC. When you walked in off the street to talk to an invisible audience from one of those deliberately boring rooms called studios, there wasn't an awful lot more to go on. Newfangled radio services like weather forecasts got a lot of attention. Here's Mabel Constant-Dureff, best known for creating the entire Buggins family in sound, playing grandma of the clan, opposite Michael Hogan as Bert Hodges, the studio manager.
Hello, Bert Hodges. I've been looking everywhere for you.
Good heavens, Grandma. What are you doing here?
I've come to find that bloke what much about with the weather.
What, the weather announcer?
They messed up the early ads for me, so first got me out of me flannels into me calico by bank holiday. And then turned on one of them depressions straight off of the ice ramp.
Oh, Phoebe, Grandma, you can't hang round here, you know. I've got to get the studio ready for a musical program.
What sort of music? The kind you can hum or the kind that depresses
you? Oh, well, you see, what these modern music and dance is being all rhythmical and primitive. Like, it might be a lot of African aborigines beating on their tom-toms.
Here, don't you forget yourself, Bert Hodges.
Aye?
You know very well that ain't a part of the body you ought to refer to in front of me.
Oh, Grandma.
If that's the sort of goings-on they have at the BBC, I'm all.
To appear to be taking John Reith's side of the censorship argument was, I suppose, one way of avoiding censorship. Not that any was really required there. Getting back to the early days of weather forecasting, though, there was another young comedian of promise having a go at that.
Hello, folks. This is Tommy Handley calling with great gusto and malice aforethought. Well, I beg to announce that owing to an outbreak of picking shots, the whooping chicks, the measles rather, at Savoy Hill, the staff has been sadly depleted, and the corporation have asked me to kind of keep the ball rolling and carry on for the rest of the evening. And now for the weather report, for the benefit of those who missed it on purpose. This morning, a deep depression settled over the south. This afternoon, my mother-in-law arrived from the north.
Mm-hmm. Two things stand out about that. One is the superbly clear and direct delivery of Tommy Handley, perfect for the early radio sets, even when the material was less than perfect. And then the word corporation, which identifies that recording as post-1926, when the British Broadcasting Company gave way to the corporation, the chartered public service broadcasting system we've had ever since. To comedy artists, the difference was probably not immediately important. It was certainly not as visible as the great move made in 1923 from Marconi House to the relatively spacious Savoy Hill, ungratefully satirised by Gilly Potter.
The BBC is in London at a place called Savoy Hill, so named after that Duke of Savoy who was never really well. It is a large building entirely surrounded by alleys which enable the officials to escape censure and the vaudeville artists to escape arrest. There are two ways in. The principal entrance is reminiscent of St. Mark's at Venice without entirely losing sight of the signal box at Chipping Sombre. Through this portico enter the brains and beauty of the BBC. Not only Lady Mary Mouthorgan, who screams across England trifles of her own composition like The Squirrel's Breakfast and My Love Lies Bloodshot, but also Professor Turtlebuttock, the authority on old waistcoats, who pesters the public periodically with some such stuff as how I avoid Sundays and why Zulus dislike asparagus. Round the corner from this splendid gateway, under an arch and up an alley, is another door, outside which stand three dustbins and two detectives. Need I say that by this door enter all the vaudeville artists.
That sort of material did quite a lot to fix in the minds of wireless license holders, paying 10 shillings or 50p a year, what this thing called the BBC looked like. What it felt like from within, only the performers really knew. B.C. Hillian was one. In 1926, he auditioned and was turned down. But within months, his new partnership with Malcolm McKechnie as Flotsam and Jetsam was so successful that the two men were invited to broadcast. A fellow artist tried to put young Flotsam off.
Norman Long, a genial entertainer at the piano with the wide, toothy smile, had been a 2LO pioneer and had warned me that this newfangled wireless was a nerve-wracking experience. You feel such a fool, he said, sitting there singing and playing to an invisible audience. You suddenly think of the thousands and thousands of unseen blighters all over the place listening to you. And you panic and you start mopping your words and fumbling the tune. Well, avoid it, old son, Norman said. It'll take years off your life. Norman Long was, of course, quite right. It was a terrifying ordeal. So usual, indeed, were microphone nerves that technicians, themselves overawed by the thrilling potentialities of this new medium, were under instructions to pamper the broadcaster, never to hurry him or to leave him alone in a studio with the transmitting apparatus. Always keep his mind off that vast, invisible army of listeners, and to see that he got a bracer, a tot of scotch or brandy, if he wanted one, from a well-stocked cabinet in the anteroom. This last-named amenity was in the charge of a gallant and gracious host, one Colonel Brand, who produced his magic key on your arrival at Savoy Hill, and again to fortify you on departure. All broadcasting ancients will recall Colonel Brand. His disappearance and the corner cabinet with him was only a matter of time. Both vanished all too soon.
And among their first offerings was a song they soon put on record in June 1927. The record engineers made such a good job of it that it still gives pleasure today. In fact, I think it's one of the little masterpieces to have come out of early broadcasting.
Little Betty bowed for his guide to her people and the nice girl for all less.
But at present on joke she's causing her folks no end of distress.
For she is quite mad about the man she's never met.
And it's all through an innocent crystal set.
Little Betty bowed for a lot to announce her down at the BBC.
She doesn't know his name, but how she rejoices when she hears that voice of voices.
Absolutely tireless, sitting at the wireless.
Oh, little Miss B.
It's the man who announces with such a lot of passion in it.
the drummer be shipping forth after the following of the little bit bouncer, lots of the bouncer down to the BBC.
Flotsam and Jetsam, with B.C. Hillim at the piano and his partner, the extraordinary Malcolm McKechnie, sometimes billed on record as Basso Supremo.
Our producer was Bertram Fryer, aided by John Sharman. Announcer, Stuart Hibbert, who was visibly embarrassed when our bouncer ditty turned out to be about himself and about how Betty had fallen in love with his velvet voice.
North and northwest. But elsewhere, the temperature will be about average. Outlook for Monday, probably rather unsettled. Second news got the right results. The whole of today's news is overshadowed and darkened by
a velvet voice of Stuart Hibbert, as it was when little Miss Bouncer fell in love with it. A very Sunday sort of voice. But then on BBC Wireless, it was Sunday most of the time, as far as rules and regulations went. Some rules were necessary because practical, like the card next to the microphone that read darkly, "If you cough, you will deafen thousands." But there were moral strictures, too, on broadcasting material. In time, these came to be enshrined in the notorious Green Book, the Variety Programme's Policy Guide, which prohibited almost anything that could have commanded a place on a seaside postcard. Honeymoon couples, lodgers and chambermaids, lavatories, fig leaves, and the habits of animals, especially rabbits. And, of course, ladies' underwear, which prompted the famous explanation in the Green Book, e.g. winter draws on. B.C. Hilliam's friend Norman Long, known on his stage really as A Song, A Smile and a Piano, but to his fellow pros as Old Teeth and Trousers, had a song about just this topic. Now, the BBC once wrote to me and said, "Dear Norman Long, we thought you'd like to face the mic with your piano, Smile and Smile. So will you bring your repertoire along for us to see, to go over it with a pencil of the blue variety?" So I looked my list of songs up to the studio I flew, and here's a nice song called Violet. They said, "Oh, that's much too blue." I said, "Is Robin Adair all right?" They said, "Robin Adair, my head. Just think of the bald-headed men you'll upset. We can't let you broadcast that." So I looked my list of songs up, determined to show my skill. I started warbling merrily that well-known song until I sang "No Road in All the World." "No Road," they cried, "my head. Why, you'll upset all the fishmongers. We can't let you broadcast that." So I looked my list of songs up, because I was beginning to tire. I said, "Well, here's a good one, a song called Strike the Liar." They said, "Strike the Liar? What on earth do you think you're at? With thousands of barristers listening in, we can't let you broadcast that." Norman Long, with the complaint of a man who did have the odd doubtful song about vegetable marrows and such in his repertoire, and a nice one about the baby Austin motor car, too. And, of course, advertising was equally inadmissible. Friends told Helena Millay she was mad to broadcast at all, because she was giving away original material she couldn't then repeat around the hall.
We were all interested in what was being built up. We thought it would be a wonderful thing in the future, I suppose, at the back of our minds, even at the back of mine, and I'm unbusinesslike enough. I suppose we thought that we were going to be famous, you see, and make a lot of money. Some hope.
The impresario, George Black, eventually withdrew all his artists from BBC work, which took several big names off the airways for many years. So, while there were great stage veterans like Harry Lauder and new theatrical stars like Noel Coward who were confident enough of their appeal to submit to the broadcasting ordeal, it was mainly in creating its own stars that radio first succeeded. Would the name of Willie Rouse, for example, have been legendary in music hall? Maybe not. But as Wireless Willie, he took his chance and had his brief period of fame.
Now that the applause has somewhat subsided. Hello, everybody. Hello. Willie Rouse, Wireless Willie calling. Hello. Now, before I begin, ladies and gentlemen, I must apologize to one of my lady admirers. Single, I hope. Very nice place. So she sent a note round to our musical director here at the studio, asking me to sing a little song that she has evidently heard me sing before. A little song called She's only a baker's daughter, but oh, how she needed my girl. It's awfully pretty song, and I sing it awfully well. Mind you, it's a companion song to a little song I used to sing very many years ago. Perhaps some of my older friends will remember it. Entitled, Don't Go Down the Ladder, Daddy, and we've taken it away. Now for the little song. Somebody put... Mrs. Brown had two little children, nice little children, boys they were, well behaved and innocent darling, till they once kicked up such a stir. From the window fell young Johnny, out his mother in a fright. Ask him why he tumbled out there. Johnny yelled with all his might. Oh, I wouldn't have done, but somebody pushed me. Somebody pushed me, they did, they did. We tried to see who could lean out the farthest. Out of the window, me and Sid. Whoever could do it, one hate me. I was a hate me. Deeply said, oh, I wouldn't have done, but somebody pushed me. Somebody pushed me, and I bumped my head. First verse, second verse, same joint, different gravy.
If Wireless Willie's name was made by radio, the reputation of some other artists was saved by it. Tommy Handley, for example, had been touring for years with a tearaway musical sketch called The Disorderly Room, which audiences were getting to know too well. Radio not only revitalized Handley's career, it brought joy to his personal life, or rather Gene. Working on the hit review show Radio Radiance, Handley and his co-star Gene Alliston fell in love, and solidized forthwith a professional partnership that sounded like this. Handley and Alliston in a typical harmless number. But in America, at the same time, more ambitiously structured comedy was being tried. By 1928, they had a hit series called Amos and Andy. And while this was almost as racially condescending as the material of the minstrel era, with two white comedians impersonating a pair of naive black taxi drivers, it did at least have complete storylines in episodes. It was, in fact, situation comedy.
Hey, by the way, did you hear about Lightning? They put him in jail for borrowing money from a man.
Well, they can't put him in jail for borrowing money from a man, can they?
Well, the way I guess it, Lightning had to knock the man down five times before he'd lend it to him.
Well, I've been doggone. You don't mean to tell me.
Well, Amos, I ain't going to stay here and argue with you. I'm going on home and study history.
What kind of history?
What do you know about the burning of Rome?
I ain't seen the paper lately. Is it on fire?
No, no. Listen, Amos. Don't you know the man that played his fiddle while Rome burned? This man sat on a wall. He was cold as ice. He was cold. That was Nero.
You thinking about Zero, ain't you?
No, no. I'm talking about the fiddle player. You don't know nothing about music. What is a scale?
What is a what?
A scale.
A scale is a feather on a fish.
Fishes don't have feathers.
How about flying fishes?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Ain't that something?
Radio sitcom in America, preserved from 1928. It would be 10 years before we had anything comparable here. They were interesting years, though, and we'll be hearing from them next time. Till then, a little number from the man without whom early radio comedy would have been, well, less controlled anyway.
Bring me my bow of burning gold. Bring me my arrows of desire. Bring me my spear. O clouds, unfold. Bring me my chariot of fire. I will not cease from mental fight, nor shall my sword sleep in my hand, till we have built Jerusalem in England's green and pleasant land.
Thank you, Mr. Beats. I don't know who it'll be, but someone will let you know.
Russell Davis wrote and presented Radio Fun, the story of radio comedy, which continues next week with the radio debuts of Stainless Stephen and Rob Wilson. The series producer is Neil Cargill.